Good morning, everybody. Today is Tuesday, February 3rd, 2015. And this is Before the First Cup with Jules here on UCY.TV. Good morning. Happy Tuesday. And it is no longer snowing. Actually, the sky is blue and it is sunny today. So sunny, single-digit temperatures with a couple feet of snow is always better than a snowstorm. I'm ready for spring. I've had about enough of this. All right, so we are going to continue, and I promised for almost 2 weeks, but we finally have made it to the point where we're going to dive into nanotech today and take a look at how it has been in our food for at least the last 15 years. They've been experimenting with it for quite a long time. Yesterday, toward the end of the show, we had listened to part of an interview with Ray Kurzweil. Yes, the head of engineering at Google, Ray Kurzweil, upload myself to the machine, daddy. Kurzweil was interviewing the father of nanotech, Eric Drexler, and it was pretty disturbing. Drexler, of course, came from MIT. He was a very smart guy, and he had even talked about how they could use nanotech actually to go in and create and manipulate DNA by using proteins or synthetic proteins and then making scaffolding in helix structures. And while I was looking this morning at some documentation, I even found some more disturbing stuff. We had also found that story on Friday in regards to Google and their life sciences lab, where they were already messing around with nanotechnology. And of course, they're going to sell it to you as the ability to find, detect, and cure cancers. Don't be a number one in line, please. Be smart enough. Be smart enough to know that this is all a plan. And actually, the one thing that I wanted to point out, and you know what, we'll get back there. Let's hear. We only got to hear from 8 minutes, 50 seconds to the end of the interview with Kurzweil and Drexler yesterday. But let's just hear the first few minutes of that interview, because I want you to hear his credentials so that you totally understand that this is not science fiction anymore, okay? This is absolutely for real. This is what they're doing. I think we've totally busted their plan. Thank God we don't have a million people that listen to the show, because then we'd be in trouble. But you could be the smart ones. I'm telling you, this is what they're doing. All right, here we go. This is the beginning of that interview. Ray Kurzweil interviews the father of nanotechnology, Eric Drexler. Maybe.
I'm Eric Drexler. and I was drawn into the field of what's now called nanotechnology when I was a student at MIT back in the 1970s. And the center of my work has been understanding what physics tells us about technologies that don't exist today, but that could be developed in the future.
All right, I'm going to stop here for 1 second, and not for a false start, but while he was talking, they were running his accomplishments, and I'd like to read these to you. So he coined the term nanotechnologies in the 1980s. Wired Magazine called him the, quote, undisputed godfather of nanotechnology. He received his Ph.D. from MIT in molecular nanotechnology, the very first degree of its kind. He was the founder of the Foresight Institute, a nonprofit think tank. Sorry, I had to kill my connection there because of the echo. A nonprofit think tank preparing the world for advanced technologies. He wrote the pioneering book Engines of Creation in 1986, introducing the nature, promise, and dangers of advanced nanotechnology. His book, Nanosystems, won the Association of American Publishers 1992 Most Outstanding Computer Science Book Award. In 1981, his paper in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences established fundamental principles of molecular design, protein engineering, and productive nanosystems. He's the chief technical advisor to NanoRex, a company developing open source design software for structural DNA nanotechnology. Now, guy, that should scare you. So there's open source design software for structural DNA nanotechnologies. I don't even know what to say about that. And he also works with the World Wildlife Fund to explore nanotechnology-based solutions to global problems like energy and climate change. Oh, my God. So, you know, when we start looking at some of the things that are going on in the sky and the environment and, you know, wondering what they're spraying on us. Guys, this, did you hear them say he's been working on this since the 70s? Nanotech is not a new thing. I first learned about it in the late 80s, early 90s on the cover of Scientific American magazine. It was actually the other day online trying to see if I could find that cover because I even remember exactly what it looks like. It looked like an electron microscope photograph of almost like some sort of, I mean, I would think of it, it almost looked like a tick to me, but I remember it had these little gears inside of it. And the fact that it was at an atomic level scale, I remember thinking to myself, wow, that's like science fiction. But it's not science fiction, and that's the point. All right, here, let's reconnect. I want to hear a little bit more of this. I just needed to establish his credentials because this guy is no slouch. All right, here we go.
Can you just speak a little bit about the history of nanotechnology from the first stirrings of the idea to your own work and what we've done since then?
What I tend to think of it as is the steady progress that people have made in control of the structure of matter at a very fine scale, and in particular with atomic precision. It was more than 100 years ago that chemists started designing and deliberately building atomically precise nanostructures in the form of synthetic molecules. Progress in understanding that grew with quantum mechanics. It grew with the growth in techniques in chemistry. The understanding of what can be done grew with the understanding of molecular biology, molecular machinery in cells. In 1959, Feynman famously pointed out that one ought to be able to build machinery that can maneuver things with enough precision to build molecules in a controlled way. Then later, I published my 1981 paper in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences that said, hey, given the technologies that we see emerging, it seems there's a path open to building the sorts of things, developing the kinds of capabilities that Feynman pointed to, and, you know, outlining a range of applications that went beyond what had been discussed before. Subsequent to that, I had a series of publications. People became more and more interested. Label nanotechnology became very popular. People promptly found that it could be applied to areas of chemistry, molecular biology, material science, fine-scale lithography of the sort that we now see in your computer. Desktop computers can now be called nanotechnology quite legitimately by present definitions.
What was the main idea in your Engines of Creation 20 years ago, and how far have we come in proving the feasibility of these ideas and implementing them?
That there's a pathway open from our present technology, step by step through more advanced fabrication technologies, that starts with atomically precise things we can build today and moves toward a very broad ability to manipulate matter at the molecular scale, building atomically precise systems with high performance. Since 1981, we've seen enormous progress both in understanding what can be achieved and in laying foundations, moving forward toward these objectives. Since then, at the theoretical level, the use of computational modeling techniques to understand what physics tells us can be built by carefully arranged molecular structures has shown that we can build computational systems that are far denser than we have today, materials that are far stronger, and so on. At the experimental level, we've seen progress from being able to make only relatively small and simple molecular structures to being able to design and fabricate structures on a scale of thousands to millions of atoms in a precise organization. And this is building on molecular machinery and biology. The expectation looking forward is that we'll be able to use that ability to make molecular machines, like those found inside the cell, that take simple molecular building blocks, put them together, and make building blocks that can then be put together to make larger systems.
Guys, the nanotech connection to all of the stuff that we see going on now, especially in the precision healthcare, the fact that they want to now have access to all of our genetic code. When we start looking at the RNAi technologies that are now happening in vaccinations, nanotech in vaccinations, and we already proved that. That's in the Gardasil 100%. That was on the manufacturer's website. When we look at the fact that he's talking about being able to build nanofactories that can then build biological structures. I mean, people, when Dr. Huber came out quite a number of years ago in regards to GMO, remember we had listened to that interview a few times. I could probably dig that up again maybe for tomorrow. And he had talked about in the soils around the GMO crops, and he had found something that wasn't viral, it wasn't bacterial, and it wasn't fungal, and the only way that he could classify it was as a new life form. I'm telling you, it was some sort of synthetic nanobiotech creation that I think that they've been playing with for a long time. The fact that Monsanto is using the same technology that the vaccine manufacturers are using for their quote-unquote Ebola vaccine has got to make your hair stand up on end. This is absolutely not cool.
Let's talk a little bit about what the potential of this would be. One thing we can build is very powerful computers. So could you give us some idea of the comparison of the computers we could build ultimately using nanotechnology to what we have today?
In the area of computation, there's a very conservative design for computational systems that can be the basis for building computers that are comparable in power to modern CPUs, but occupy approximately 1 cubic micron. And putting the power of a modern-day computer, modern-day CPU, into a cubic micron lets you deliver that kind of computational power in a volume that's about 1/1000th that of one of the cells in your body.
Did you hear that? To take a computer of today's stature and power and put it into 1 cubic micron and then be able to use it inside cells.
And I think that says something about the kinds of tools that will be available for biomedical instrumentation and intervention in the future.
Now, another promise of this technology is to have basically tabletop factories, but factories that are not big buildings, but that sit on a table, that can make what?
Macroscopic kilogram scale objects in which the components and materials are as good or better than the best that you find in experimental laboratories today. That means, for example, materials that are 50 times stronger than what the space shuttle is built out of. The computers where, again, a CPU can fit into a cubic micron. And looking at the costs of these products, you could look at the energy required, you can look at the materials required, you can look at the cost of capital, labor, etc. The costs seem to come out somewhere in the dollars per kilogram range, which is rather inexpensive considering that the capabilities will be up beyond today's state of the art.
So basically, physical products become information. I mean, right now you can take an information file and create a movie or a music recording or a book. So we'll be able to take information files that describe some physical object and create most of the things we need in our daily lives.
I mean, he's almost talking like 3D printing, taking an information file and creating a physical object, but taking it down to the nano size.
Yes, the way to think of this is very much as a nanoscale components being the starting point for manufacturing of the sort that we see in macroscopic factories. And increasingly, those factories are automated systems that are using processes that were designed in an automated way by software to make products that were designed in software.
I mean, to me, this is like the replicator. The replicator we saw in Star Trek is being able to take atoms and organize them in a fashion to create products and organisms.
One concept for how a nanofactory could be organized to have high productivity, despite the fact that the materials being handled are at the scale of individual molecules, would be to have a two-dimensional array of micron scale, actually somewhat smaller devices that are processing small molecular fragments. They would put these parts together to make larger structures. The next layer would put those together to make larger structures and so on. So you would have many trillions in the first layer, progressively fewer, progressively larger products, until out the other end you would have things at the macroscopic scale. And if you just do the physics-based analysis of that, you find that the production rates can be very high, that a system that sits on your desktop could produce its own mass in sophisticated products in a matter of hours.
Neil Gershenfeld has a concept called Fab Lab and refers to your work actually as the goal, and he articulates his own vision of a roadmap, basically going from what he currently has is sort of multi-micrometer features, micron features, to finer and finer features, ultimately down to multi-nanometer features.
Well, broadly speaking, there have been two ways of approaching control of matter at the nanoscale. One is top-down, which generally hasn't given atomically precise control, but is moving down toward a scale that is similar. The other one is bottom-up. You start with atomic precision, and you build larger and larger, more and more intricate structures as you go along. The top-down approach, which I gather is what Neil is pursuing, I think is likely to meet in the middle with the building up from the molecular scale.
How do you see these two worlds interacting? I mean, can we learn lessons from biology? Can we actually use components from biology? Can we take biological systems like cells or ribosomes and modify them to create other nanomachines? What's the interaction between the biological world and what we're trying to create?
The most central interaction, from my point of view, is the use of the molecular machinery found in cells, programmable productive machinery, to make components. Your cells contain ribosomes, which are programmable machine tools. They take in RNA, which has information from DNA. That RNA tape, it's digital information, is used to direct the formation, the construction of protein molecules, which are little chunks of material that are about as strong and stiff as something like polycarbonate plastic or epoxy. And they're the building blocks for molecular machinery in the cell. So you have a molecular machine that can be controlled to make components for more molecular machines. What we're learning to do is to program this biological machinery to make components that fit together to make structures designed by scientists and engineers. At present, one of the most impressive technologies is called structural DNA nanotechnology, which uses DNA not as an information molecule, not as a genetic molecule, but as a structure. You have the double helix and you treat it as a cylindrical strut. They can be linked together by having strands cross over from one to another. And researchers have made structures on a scale of millions of atoms. I think, though, that we'll very rapidly find that the non-biological materials are, for engineering purposes, better. And at that point, biology will be more teaching us lessons and being an area of application. Early products I would expect to include a wide range of instruments that are useful for biomedical applications, for example.
All right, I'm going to stop it there. We heard the rest of that yesterday. Now, if that doesn't scare you, I don't know what does, but you know, one of the things that we're seeing a lot of out of DARPA, especially where we have all this black hole money going into these freak technologies, is that they are using nature. They are using nature's ability over millions of years of evolution to design and create machinery. And they're finding ways to synthetically recreate nature and then make synthetic in this case, molecules, but I mean, they're doing all kinds of synthetic biology. They are, in essence, looking to replace us. They're looking to replace the biological machine, and the end result of that is immortality. Now, this whole push for Google getting into healthcare and using nanotechnology in healthcare. We looked at that yesterday. I couldn't believe my eyes, but yes, I looked into the life sciences lab, and Google has been running this for quite a while now. They have over 100 doctors working for them, coming up with solutions for your healthcare, because you know why? Because Google cares about you. No, they don't really. Now, listen, a few weeks ago, actually, this was last week, we managed to dig up three short little clips from Kurzweil. Now, anyone who ever paid attention to Kurzweil, when he was announced to be the new head of engineering at Google, you probably did what I did and said, oh my God, it is the unholy trinity. It's Google, DARPA, because we had Regina Duggan sitting up in the top seat there. She took on the whole smart technology realm with the Motorola division, as well as Samsung. So this is going to be the Internet of Things. We've seen the CEO of Google, Eric Schmidt, just recently came out and said that the internet will be no more because it'll be integrated into everything. And don't think it's just your clothing. It's going to be integrated into your body, guys. They can put today's PC in a cubic micron. Okay, Regina Duggan talked about swallowing pills that then will give you superpowers, she said. Well, in the Google article we read yesterday about nanotech, that's exactly what they are suggesting, that you'll be able to swallow these pills once or twice a week loaded with nanotech. They'll all get into your bloodstream, and they'll be scanning for disease. You'll have a wristband on, which would be just like the Internet of Things. They have those new smartwatches that can interconnect already with devices that are smart within your home, and they'll be able to scan your body for disease. But Ray Kurzweil is an interesting cat in that Ray Kurzweil, and if you look into his history, he's a very strange dude, and we're not going to get into his motivations for wanting to be immortal, but Ray Kurzweil has been one of the forefront for the singularity, the forefront, the spokesperson for man merging with machine. And when he first got hired as director of engineering for Google, there was an interview that disappeared very quickly, but he had literally said that he had an unlimited budget to be able to mess around with these technologies. I want to play And these little clippies are from a few years ago. But there are three of them. One is called Ray Kurzweil, I'm Bringing Back the Dead. Ray Kurzweil on the Immortality Cocktail, and Ray Kurzweil on Melding Man and Machine. I mean, this is what this guy does. This is his red button that he has dedicated his life to, and he wants to be the machine. So the fact that this guy is in charge of now research and development and engineering and unlimited budgets, and they've partnered with the federal government. They're part of the Brain Project. Now they're part of this precision healthcare that's going to tie in geneticists and venture capitalists and the FDA and your doctor and the electronic databases. We should be very afraid. This is happening under our noses. And it's a matter of fact, it's been happening for a while. This is the end game. All right, Ray Kurzweil, I'm Bringing Back the Dead.
How much of your project is motivated by your dad, his early death, and your yearning for him?
My father's disease definitely impressed upon me our mortality and the grave limitations of our biology, because he got sick when I was 15. He died when I was 22. And I also felt it was a cloud in my own future, because I felt I probably inherited his genetic disposition. That became clear in my 30s when I was diagnosed with type 2 diabetes. And it was at that time that I really took this seriously. When I was in my 20s, I felt, okay, this is on my long-term to-do list. I will have to deal with this at some point. When I got to my 30s and was diagnosed with type 2 diabetes, I felt, okay, the time has come. I tried the traditional approach for a while. It actually made things worse. So then I actually sat down, okay, I'm going to approach this as a scientist and as an engineer and gather all the information that's known. And clinical practice does not necessarily reflect all of the information we have. And I came up with my own program and saw that we really do have the means, at least in some cases, and fortunately in mine, to overcome our genetic disposition with our own knowledge and ideas. And the knowledge we have is growing. And we have this whole field of biotechnology where we're gaining the means to reprogram our biology, just the way we reprogram our cell phones. And this is downloading new software now as we speak. But I'm still walking around with outdated software that evolved thousands of years ago. So I've changed my software in some ways, and that I have a cholesterol of 100 rather than 280, and many other things like that have improved.
Do you think you can bring back your father in a way that he would have continuity of consciousness?
I've got, in fact, hundreds of boxes of documents and recordings and movies and photographs, and I'm in the process of digitizing all that. And actually a very good way to express all of this documentation of my father, who's a musician. I have all of his music. I have all of his letters. I have movies and other artifacts. Would be to create an avatar that an AI would create that would be as much like my father as possible, given the information we have about him, and including possibly his DNA. That person would be very much like my father. You could argue that he would be more like my father than my father would be had he been alive now, which he would be close to 100, so it's possible he could be alive, but he wouldn't be very similar to the way he was when he was 58 and died, you know, over 40 years ago. And he would pass a Frederick Kurzweil Turing test with me as the judge or anyone else who knew him.
And the Turing test, named after the computer pioneer Alan Turing, what is that?
The classical Turing test is you have a human judge and you have an artificial intelligence and a human foil, or maybe several of each, and the human judge interviews them both. Or all of them. And he or she can't tell the difference, we say the computers have passed the Turing test. And in my view, if an entity passes a Turing test for being human, let alone a specific person, that person is conscious. Now, you raise another question, okay, this avatar of your father will be a conscious person and it will convince you that it's your father based on your faded memories of him. But that doesn't mean it's actually his consciousness. It doesn't have his identity, and that may be true. These are philosophical issues for which you can't really resolve scientifically.
Yes, you can't resolve scientifically except with the Brain Project. That's really going to help them work the bugs out of being able to bring back consciousness, being able to understand how the brain works in absolute explicit detail, being able to understand how every neuron connects and what reactions, what memories are stored in each part of the brain. I mean, they asked some pretty disturbing questions. Yes, his father dying was what Kurzweil had always stated was what propelled him into the science of this madness, but he really is looking to be able to put human consciousness into the machine, and this is the next part of this interview.
What do you mean when you use the term singularity?
In physics, singularity is a black hole. There's a theoretical point of infinite force and gravity. But there's an event horizon, which is actually fairly large, around the black hole. And within that event horizon, gravity is so great that the light can't get out. So we can't actually see what's going on inside because all of the electromagnetic energy is kept inside that event horizon. So it's hard to see beyond the event horizon because the forces are so great. So that's the metaphor we're borrowing, that the changes are so profound past around 2045, that we can't easily see beyond them and see how current trends will continue.
And that singularity you're describing is a melding of man and machine, so you can't tell one from the other, really.
Right. My view is that it's not us versus them. We're going to merge with them. This is metaphorical in terms of the whole access to information technology I use.
And that's your cell phone.
Yeah. And it's a gateway to the cloud of resources. And that makes me smarter, and it's part of who I am. And in fact, if I'm cut off from access, maybe not this physical device, but some access to the cloud of resources, information resources, I feel less than complete. And I use them all the time, and I'm not unique. So whether it's inside my body or not, I think is an arbitrary distinction. But there are people already putting computers inside their bodies and brains, computerized pancreas replacements or neural implants that are connected into the brain, like for Parkinson's patients, or cochlear implants for the deaf. And the latest generation of neural implants for Parkinson's patients allows you to download new software to the implant connected into your brain from outside the patient. So these technologies are already part of who we are. They're so small, we carry them around. They're in our pockets or on our belts. They'll become even more closely integrated. If you go out a few years, certainly by 5 or 6 years, instead of looking at a little screen, the whole visual field of view will be our screen because we'll put them in our eyeglasses and contact lenses. These already exist. In fact, Google's about to come out with glasses like this for augmented reality, a virtual reality environment that will be highly realistic. And we'll be sort of immersed in this augmentation of our reality at all times. And the electronics will be so small, it'll be hidden in our clothing. It will make its way into our bodies and brains. So our thinking will become a hybrid of biological and non-biological thinking. The non-biological part will be backed up because we naturally back up anything that's computerized.
Everything to the cloud is part of the Internet of Things. I mean, I hope I am painting a disturbing picture for you because this, I can't even, I mean, it's so beyond science fiction. And the fact that this is being researched with billions of dollars, especially billions of tax dollars, but also venture capitalist dollars, this is for real. They are working on this right now as we speak.
Ultimately, that will be where the action is. And it'll become so intelligent, it will be able to model the biological part too. So that will also get backed up.
Crudely, I guess, I've been defining immortality as continuity of consciousness. Is that, do you think, the right metric?
I think actually it is the right metric. In my view, my identity has to do with continuity of the thinking process. Because actually, I'm not the same stuff I was even 6 months ago. Most of the cells in my body actually die and are recreated. The neurons persist, but the components of the neurons, the tubules, the filaments, the ion channels, they get destroyed and recreated. I'm completely different physical stuff than I was, but I have the same pattern, or at least as a continuity of pattern. Right outside my window here is a river, Charles River. And you can ask, is that the same river that it was yesterday? And there's an ancient proverb that says you can't walk in the same river twice. It's completely different water than it was just a few seconds ago. But the pattern that it makes as it goes around the rocks stays the same for days, for years. Now, over time, that pattern may change a little. And I'm not exactly the same as I was 6 months ago. But there's a continuity of the pattern. I'm just like a river. The particles flow through it. The pattern changes very slowly. The actual particles change quickly. So it's a continuity, not of the stuff, not the physical particles, but of the pattern that constitutes identity. And I think, yes, as we introduce technology into our bodies and brains, we're still keeping that continuity. I've actually asked this question to Parkinson's patients. Hey, you've got a computer inside your body. They put it right here, and it's connected into your brain. Are you still the same person? Are you still human? And because you ask the same question to different people, you get different answers. But almost everyone will say, yes, I'm the same person that I was, and I'm still human. In fact, I'm more human than I was because I've restored, you know, this important capability.
Now, if we step back for a second and think about everything we've heard over the last 36 minutes or so in regards to nanotechnology, immortality, bringing back the dead, integrating the machine into our bodies, and the future of what they hope it will mean. Google, now, you know, jumping on board with putting nanotech into our bloodstreams to help diagnose disease. And then we look at the precision healthcare that Obama talked about as our new push forward as a nation in his State of the Union. I want to read this quick story out of CNBC. Precision medicine takes genetic mapping to the next level. In the past 10 years, analyzing a single individual's genome has gone from a substantial scientific effort, one that took 9 months and $100 million, to an increasingly easy process that could be done in days, if not hours, and cost as little as $1,000. The lower price of genome sequencing and increased speed with which your genetic information can be gleaned means, of course, yes, better disease detection, prevention, and protection. Detection, prevention, and protection, personalized drug regimes, and voluminous amounts of medical research data. It is the kind of advancement that will mean not only longer lifespans, but longer spans of healthy and active lives for many of us. Yes, many being the rich people. I'm telling you, this is not for you and me. Already, genetic, we're just the R&D line item budget, remember. Electronic health records, HIPAA goes away, all your data is available as software as a service. Biopharma genomics institutes have access, free access or monthly access to your data to use for their research and development without spending billions of dollars like they had in the past. The shareholders for those companies are happy. You become the guinea pig and the rich people get the benefit. With a trained practitioner and the appropriate diagnostics, you can learn if you have a genetic predisposition to, let's say, early menopause, for instance, allowing you the chance to decide whether to get pregnant now or to freeze your eggs. Or, hey, like New World Order shill Angelina Jolie, genetic predisposition for breast cancer so you get your boobs cut off. I still don't believe that. I absolutely do not believe that she had that done. I think that was just to put it in the mind's eye that, look, somebody like Angelina Jolie had this genetic predisposition and it's coming to a doctor's office near you and you too can be the future of medicine. Or if you're in the danger, if you're in the danger zone of a heart attack, even though you are a triathlete, you could take care of your situation beforehand. If you have a predisposition to a disease, maybe sparked by stress, it gives you time to explore meditation, not medication. This proactive and deeply personalized approach is clearly the future of medicine. But with Obama's announcement of a new precision medicine initiative during the State of the Union address, we may see an acceleration of both funding and availability for this wealth of genetic data. The president gives a little detail. He said, quote, "Tonight, I am launching a new precision medicine initiative to bring us closer to curing diseases like, yes, I told you, cancer and, oh, diabetes, and to give us all access to personalized information we need to keep ourselves and our families healthier." Do, do, do. Now, remember, Obamacare has part of its initiative, the electronic medical health records. Obamacare also is not designated as a healthcare plan. We looked at that last week. Kathleen Sebelius, when she put out the memo stating it wasn't a healthcare plan, it got rid of all of the protections that were in place for Medicare and Medicaid. So Obamacare is not covered by the anti-kickback statutes. It means everybody gets rich. That means Big Pharma gets rich. Your doctor gets rich. Everybody has access to your data. Obama talked about getting rid of those pesky HIPAA privacy laws. And we're going to look at that. I actually just found a story, like I said, right before I went on air that even talked about getting rid of HIPAA. And oh, how horrible. If we don't get rid of it all, none of this is going to work. Back to the story. The White House has promised more information about what all this means, but a few things are apparent. First, the attention and funding that could come to this field will be of tremendous benefit to vitality and lifespans. 21st century technology and its interpretation by adept clinicians will allow individuals to drill down beneath the surface, deep into the complex cellular substances of life and genetic material that make each of us a uniquely functioning laboratory. Yeah, I like the way they word that. Second, expanded precision medicine availability will be a colossal disruptor of many healthcare system components, from family doctors to hospital systems to medical insurers. Once this approach takes hold in the popular perception, the healthcare consumer, particularly the baby boomers, will seek greater ownership of their personal health destiny. Yeah, I think really they're trying to begin the capitalization on the baby boomers, the last generation that actually did better than their parents because they still have the money. Lastly, complex raw data requires expert analysis, and there will be a wide and frustrating gap, especially at first, between the promise of what can be done with genetic information and the realities of understanding the data and making it actionable. Already, this has occurred with 23andMe, the mail-in genetic reporting kit that had to stop selling part of its service due to FDA objections. The raw data needed expert translation to be meaningful. I believe, too, the 23andMe people were somehow related to one of the big boys. I'll have to look at that after I get off air, but I thought it was somebody at Google. Well, look at that. 23andMe, I mean, they're still in business. They just were concerned that when they were saying, oh, you have a genetic predisposition for breast cancer, because this was just a service. And it wasn't some sort of like medical clinician giving you that information. They felt that there was a greater issue with someone than trying to find something actionable to go after. So like if 23andMe, I mean, it's a commercial service. It wasn't a healthcare service. Not that I trust any of them, but they didn't want them, just like your vitamins, right? They can't sell vitamins and tell you that Vitamin D is good for serotonin production, let's say, or against helps you against seasonal affective disorder, because that hasn't been proven in a laboratory. Anyway, let's finish the story. Given the proper funding, my view as to what would bring the greatest benefits to the health of our nation is, one, established precision medicine training in medical schools for new doctors and physicians who desire to retool. Few clinicians have trained in this field, and most medical schools do not include precision medicine in their curricula. Two, make genetic mapping universally available. This is what I was saying. HIPAA laws out a window. And begin to build a database that can move the medical profession away from one-size-fits-all treatments and interventions. And remember, last week or the week before when we kicked all this off at looking at this complete insanity, was that what's all behind it? IBM's Watson, cognitive healthcare computing. Watson is going to be the central key to all of this. To get the maximum value from precision medicine, however, what may be needed above all is a new mindset in both physicians and patients, a mindset that focuses not on treating diseases after the symptoms have emerged, but instead on detecting, reversing, and even eliminating disease long before anyone feels sick. And you know, here's the thing. It's a great pie in the sky. And it would be if all of those in charge and those handling your information and those that are doing the research were benevolent gods. But they're not. We're putting the power of gods into the hands of psychopaths. We're putting the power of gods to create life and destroy life. Remember, with the good always comes the bad. Into the hands of people that think there needs to be a depopulation, that we have too many people on this planet, that we're producing too much carbon dioxide. This cannot be a good thing. All right. So now on to nanotechnology. We've come full circle. There was a story that came out of, and I really hate, they just hijacked my page with an ad. There was a story that came out of Popular Mechanics February 19th, 2014, so just under a year ago, titled, "Wait, there's nanotechnology in my food?" Well, yes. If you've been listening to Before the First Cup, you'd know that. But just in case this is your first time, we're going to look at this story. Think about your last meal, whether it was a big juicy burger or a kale and spinach sandwich. There was a good chance that something in that meal was grown or preserved with nanotechnology. For little more than a decade, the food industry, and actually we can go back at least 15 years, we'll see in another story. For little more than a decade, the food industry has been using nanotechnology to change the way we grow and maintain our food. The grocery chain Albertsons currently has a list of nanotech-touched foods in its home brand, ranging from cookies to cheese blends. Nanotechnology use in food has real advantages. The technology gives producers the power to control how food looks, tastes, and even how long it lasts. Looks good and good for you too? Well, the most commonly used nanoparticle in foods is titanium dioxide. And you know, I believe I've seen Rode say many times, look for titanium dioxide in your vitamins. You want to stay away from that. This says it is used to make foods such as yogurt and coconut flakes look as white as possible, providing opacity to other food colorings and prevent ingredients from caking up. Nanotech isn't just about aesthetics, however. The biggest potential use for this method involves improving the nutritional value of food. Nano additives can enhance and prevent the absorption of certain nutrients. It can prevent the absorption of certain nutrients. Now remember, the lunatics running the asylum would like to have you sick, because when you're sick, you go to the doctor. Some of us do. Most of us don't, at least listening to the show. But the general American public will go to the doctor, and doctors only know how to treat things with pharmaceuticals. In an email interview with Popular Mechanics, Jonathan Brown, a research fellow at the University of Minnesota, says that this method could be used to make mayonnaise less fattening by replacing fat molecules with water droplets. Nanotech also helps keep food fresher over a longer period. Brown says that nanopackaging is actually larger than its nano food counterpart and that it has three main focuses. Isn't the plural of focus foci? The three main focuses are barriers, antimicrobials, and sensors. Ideally, the packaging would provide protection from moisture, bacteria, and pathogens. And there is also a type of packaging that would involve what Brown calls oxygen scavenging, which means that the package would absorb oxygen before it reaches food. Other technologies have involved coating the packaging with nanosilver particles to make them antimicrobial, using polypropylene and polyethylene barriers to inhibit moisture, and even embed packages with silicon-based nanoparticles that can detect pathogens. These are all currently being tested, but Brown says that the experimental food packaging has been successful in lab settings. But even though this seems like the best way to ease nanotech into the food industry, concerns exist. Quote, the main concern is that nanomaterials in the packages could migrate from the package to the food. Oh, you think? Some studies have demonstrated that certain nanomaterial packages are indeed stable and no migration has been seen. But remember, a lot of this is being done at the manufacturer and the food production level. They all have their own scientists. There is no central nanotech department at any federal regulatory agency that I'm aware of. And the FDA pretty much gives rubber stamps to all this stuff because once they proved that it was safe, it's always safe, just like GMO. The projections for market use of nanofoods are huge but highly speculative. Some are also really weird. Kraft has shown interest in creating a smart blob that could become any kind of food with any kind of flavor using nanotech. That sounds like the food replicator. Basically, you could put this yummy blob into the microwave. Oh, my God. Basically, you could put this yummy blob into the microwave and specify what you'd like it to be. Nanoparticles in the food would be activated by the appliance and change color, shape, and possibly even nutrients. Eventually, the hope is that the food product could become so smart that it would even be able to tell what ingredient one is allergic to and block it. If you want to know what companies are using nanotech in their food or their packaging, check out this user-maintained database called the Consumer Products Inventory at the Project on Emerging Nanotechnologies website. It lists more than 1,600 manufacturer-identified nanotech consumer products. And we'll actually hit that quick after I read the end of the story. Regulation required, yes. Aside from requiring manufacturers to provide proof that nanotechnology foods are safe, the FDA has yet to implement specific testing of its own. Well, there you go. But many countries are researching ways to balance innovation and regulation in this market. In 2012, the European Food Safety Authority released an annual risk assessment report outlining how the European Union is addressing the issues of nanotech in food. In Canada, the Food Directorate is taking a case-by-case approach to the safety assessment of food products containing or using nanomaterials, or at least someone in Canada is thinking. It should be on a case-by-case basis, not just a sweeping stamp of approval. The lack of regulation is a problem for Friends of the Earth, an environmental group advocating a ban on nanofood till tests have been done to ensure its safety. Even Brown admits that risks in food are hard to quantify due to lack of research. And the thing is, guys, we heard Eric Drexel, the father of nanotechnology, telling us about all the things that they can do and all the things they can create and how it can be in your bloodstream and how they can manufacture RNA and DNA and double helixes. This should be extremely disturbing to every single one of us. You don't want this shit not only in your food, in your body, or in your environment. And once the genie's out of the bottle, because it already is, it's going to be too late to put it back. Quote, we don't know the risks of nanomaterials in food or how the human reacts to nano additives and where those nano additives may end up in the environment, he says. We're left with mostly ambiguity, where initial studies indicate some health risks of certain nanomaterials under certain settings, but these obviously don't apply to all nanomaterials, nor do they necessarily reflect the risks of nanofoods themselves. All I got to say is if somebody like Kraft releases a blob that you put into your microwave and then program it for what food you want it to turn into, run away screaming, waving your hands in the air. That's just horrifying. All right. Well, this consumer product inventory, an inventory of nanotechnology-based consumer products introduced on the market. After more than 20 years of basic and applied research, nanotechnologies are gaining in commercial use. Like I said, it had been more than 15. I mean, honestly, I saw it right at the, it had to be the very end of the 80s, beginning of the 90s. I'd say between the years of 89 and 91. Is when I first heard about nanotechnology. And Drexel said he'd been working on it since the late 70s at MIT. MIT is funded a lot by DARPA. And remember, MIT and Harvard are where they're working on a lot of the artificial intelligence, the unmanned aerial micro vehicles, the robo-bees. Oh, it's not a pretty picture. Okay, let me finish reading this. But it has been difficult to find out how many nano consumer products are on the market and which merchandise could be called nano. While not comprehensive, this inventory gives the public the best available look at 1,600 plus manufacturer identified nanotechnology-based consumer products introduced to the market. This living inventory is a resource for consumers, citizens, policymakers, and others who are interested in learning about how nanotechnology enters the marketplace. There is absolutely no way that I'm going to be able to go through all of this, especially with only a minute left. But there is a browse section by product, name, category, company, country, and more, a search section, keywords, categories, countries, companies, and more, and an about. You can find this database at nanotechproject.org/C as in Charles, P as in Peter, I as in inventory, or C as in consumer, P as in products, I as in inventory, nanotechproject.org/CPI. And I think we are going to roll out this show. Tomorrow we'll get into the rest. I have a whole bunch of stories on this, but I think we're going to roll out the show looking at this last statement here. Maybe, and this is out of a financial publication talking about nanotech, and it's a quote, maybe when the medical researcher searches your data, you get to see which researchers searched it and why, and imagine that that would save 10,000 lives in the first year. And this is talking about Google's life sciences nanotech jump. And it says at the very end, just that it's almost impossible to do right now because of HIPAA regulations. I told you, HIPAA is going to go away and your body and everything in it, every cell, every gene is going to become no longer your personal property. All right, guys, 10 seconds left. It's Tuesday night. Tuesday's always a busy night at UCY. Make sure you stick around. Mr. Kevin Blanch is up next live. Nuclear Hot Seat with Libby Haleve follows that. We got a brand new Ocelli Effect at 6 p.m. Eastern tonight. All things apocalyptic at 8. 9 p.m. live with Michael and Nick, Primer Time. Chicks After Dark at 10 p.m. Eastern. Anti-Media Radio, Seth Gibson, and Gigi Young at 11. All right, guys, everyone have a happy Tuesday.